This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. There is a persistent and powerful myth in the United States of a past where hardworking Americans could get good-paying jobs, offer fealty to their employers in exchange for fairness and loyalty, and have long and satisfying careers, amass just enough wealth to live comfortably on, and in general have a better life than the previous generation. There is a grain of truth to that myth for many older Americans, but today we have the so-called gig economy, where workers are expected to offer themselves up as freelance contractors to a myriad of employers for few to no benefits and appallingly low wages. What happened to the social contract that many Americans grew to expect from private employers? In a new book, author Rick Wartzman explores that history through the stories of four iconic corporate giants: Coca-Cola, General Motors, General Electric, and Kodak. Rick Wartzman is director of the K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute, part of Claremont Graduate University. His earlier books include Obscene in the Extreme, The King of California, and What Would Drucker Do Now? And he now joins me to discuss his new book, The End of Loyalty: The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs. Welcome to the program, Rick.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first, I used the term persistent and powerful myth because, of course, not all Americans, even back in the 50s, had all those opportunities. But there was this sense that there was a possibility of having a good life. And many Americans, particularly white middle-class Americans, had good jobs in many parts of the country. How true is that myth? How much of, just so we can get a sense of how far we've fallen.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it is in part a myth, or the way I think about it is that history is always pretty messy. It's never really black and white. My book begins really at the end of World War II traces the history of the social contract, as you say, which I define as job security, pay, retirement security, pensions, and health care coverage, employer-provided health care coverage. And what happened to those things over really this 70-year arc from the end of World War II until today? And in this so-called golden age, as many refer to it, from the late 40s up until the early 1970s, there was in fact a huge swath of the American workforce that saw steadily rising pay with very good job security, and benefits rose also and were ever increasing and better, both in terms of pensions and healthcare coverage. It comes with a giant asterisk, as you say. I mean, this was mainly true if you were white and male. People of color and women were in many ways excluded from the workplace and faced huge amounts of discrimination. That began to change in many ways in the 60s and into the 70s, although there's still obviously a tremendous amount of discrimination today for people of color and for women. But this golden age, you know, by and large, if you look at the numbers, most households did find that their incomes were steadily rising. They did have good job security. They did have ever increasing benefits. It really was a golden age in many ways for many people.
So let's take the example of one of the corporations that you profile in your book, General Motors. This idea of the hardworking auto worker that gave his working years to a corporation that in turn rewarded him for his loyalty. How much of General Motors' culture of employer-employee relations was really grounded in this idea of loyalty?
It was very much grounded that way. Look, this was not just a matter of companies being munificent and handing out large benefits. In the case of General Motors, as well as General Electric, and to some degree Coca-Cola at the bottling plant level, where most of its people actually work through the Coke system, you know, in each of those cases, and as emblematic, you know, across the economy in many ways, a lot of the gains that workers had were hard won by unions, by organized labor. So in the case of GM, of course, it was the United Auto Workers. And there was often blood spilled in the course of winning higher pay and better working conditions and ever better benefits. So I don't want to make this sound like it was just a matter of corporations being generous. But there was also at the same time definitely a feeling, a different corporate culture, a different corporate ethic that was prevalent at General Motors and the other companies I looked at, and again by extension across the economy. Where coming out of the Great Depression and World War II, it was a generation that I think felt more like we're all in this together. CEOs in those days, including those at General Motors, the longtime chairman, Alfred Sloan, spoke this way for sure, about having kind of a stakeholder mentality, if you will. They talked very explicitly about balancing the interests of all their constituencies, if you will. So not only their shareholders, that was important, but also their workers and their customers and the communities that they operated in. Companies even used to brag in those days about how much they paid the government in taxes and helped to fill the state's coffers, which they saw as an important responsibility. That whole ethic was over time supplanted by, I think in the most general sense, we went from a we culture to an I culture in America, and that corporate culture reflected those larger societal norms. And the way that manifested itself, has manifested itself at the corporate level, is that this stakeholder approach has been replaced very much by an idea of maximizing shareholder value, that investors come first. No longer is the discussion around how to balance the interests of all these different groups.
Right. So rather than your workers, it's the shareholders that are prioritized. And then workers have been turned into simply a line item, right? How to minimize payroll so that line item in your yearly financial reports just gets smaller and smaller in order to keep shareholders happy. How did that transition happen? Obviously, it wasn't something that happened overnight, and it must have been something in not just the social culture of this country, but also this myth of capitalism as being noble, right? That we are a capitalist country, therefore everything in the service of capitalism must be good?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely kind of an intellectual movement which took hold really in the 1970s. By the mid-70s, it was really gaining hold. It started in the academy, and the idea was that the marketplace is sacrosanct, that the marketplace is the great solver of all kinds of problems and can take care of all kinds of ills if we just get out of its way. And you see this, and you saw this kind of begin to permeate business schools and law schools in particular. Ronald Reagan was obviously a great patron of this. Many trace the origins of this maximizing shareholder value movement, if you will, to an important essay that Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist, wrote in 1970 in the New York Times Magazine, where he said that business really has one and only one social responsibility, and that is for managers to act as the agents of the shareholder. Thus was born this idea of agency theory, as the scholars call it, and that managers are supposed to act as agents of the shareholders and do just one thing, which is maximize profit and maximize share price. And doing anything else, Friedman wrote, including trying to foster more employment, say, through the economy, was, in his words, pure and unadulterated socialism. This idea took hold. There were other academics, most prevalently, Michael Jensen, who was then at the University of Rochester School of Management, later at Harvard, kind of put forward the same idea of agency theory. And then it really transitioned from kind of the ivory tower into the realm of practice. And so this maximizing shareholder value idea began to really be embraced by corporations and by investors at an accelerating pace through the 80s and 90s. And into today. The last thing I would say about it, which is really important, is that CEO pay, the way that CEOs are compensated, began to be linked very explicitly to stock price. So more and more of their paychecks were tied to stock and stock options than they had been historically. CEOs always got some pay in stock, or usually they did if they worked at a big company, but it was a tiny percentage of their overall pay package. It's now somewhere between 50 and 80%, depending on how you measure it. And so now it is very much in the interests of CEOs to see stock price go up, often in the short term. And as a result, their own pay has skyrocketed. It held steady at about $1 million a year in constant dollars, apples to apples, from the 1930s all the way through the 70s. And then it doubled in the 1980s to 2 million, doubled again to 4 million on average, again in constant terms in the 90s. And now we're somewhere between $13 and $16 million on average.
Wow.
Depending on how you measure it. And so it's very much in their personal interest to focus on profit and stock price. And when you do that, it's exactly as you say. Suddenly, employees look like an avoidable expense, not as an asset you invest in.
Right. And so we have a situation today where we have a major company like Uber that's simply trying to write out its employees out of the equation altogether, its drivers, you know, through its research and automated self-driving cars. But what about the role of unions? What role did unions play in this transition where you did have some sense of loyalty that corporations had to their workers, to today where workers are so expendable? We know that the labor movement in this country has been dramatically weakened, and there really has been this sort of countercultural war against unions, where unions are somehow seen as far more evil and antithetical to workers' rights than corporations, even today where there's so much evidence of how poorly corporations treat workers.
Yeah, it really has been an amazing thing to see unfold when you look at the long history. So I spend a lot of time early in my book talking about the role of organized labor, the role of unions. And that's really because they were so important in forging the social contract, not only the literal agreements that they negotiated at the bargaining table with General Motors and General Electric and so on, but when you had about 25 up to really 35% at one point in the 50s of the American workforce that was unionized, all the research tells us that when you get to that point, there's a tremendous spillover effect through the rest of the economy. And so unions, their wins at the bargaining table not only directly impacted those carrying a union card, but other workers, other blue-collar workers, benefited tremendously because their own employers, often to try to prevent from being unionized, needed to keep up and needed to offer their own workers better pay and better conditions and better benefits. At the same time, even white-collar workers benefited. Often their benefit packages were patterned at what unions like the United Auto Workers won at the bargaining table. And so one of the reasons that this social contract was so vast is because of the impact that unions had. I mean, they basically, again, at 25, 35% of the American workforce, they presented a real countervailing force to corporate power. There was kind of a balance there. Now you have about 6% or so, a little more than that, but basically around 6% of the private sector workforce in America unionized. And so there is no longer that spillover effect. There is no longer that countervailing force.
Do you feel that in trying to return to this culture of where, you know, where corporations do actually treat their employees as real human beings, that we do need, that an essential part of the equation has to be rise in union jobs and gains for unions? That really, we can't, the only way to force corporations into treating its employees as human beings is to unionize, is to get your collective bargaining power together and, you know, force the issue.
Yeah. There's certainly some who are calling for that. And look, I would love to see unions regain more of their numbers that they had. I don't think we're going back to 25 to 30, you know, plus percent of the workforce being unionized, though. It's for a bunch of reasons. One is the structure of the economy has changed so much. As we move away from manufacturing in terms of total employment. We still produce a lot of things in this country. Our industrial output is actually higher than it was in the 1950s. We make a lot of stuff. It just doesn't take that many people to do it. Factories, you know, you walk in, they're devoid of people, you know, they're pretty empty places. And so as we've shifted into kind of a more of a low wage service economy, you know, there's no longer thousands of people who can just as a matter of logistics, an organization can be pooled together and organized at one factory complex, right? A fast food outlet doesn't have that many people, even a big box retailer. There are just not that many people under one roof. So it's harder logistically. Unions are themselves have made a lot of missteps. They stopped focusing on organizing after a while. There were periods of corruption and their own kind of bureaucratic missteps that have really hurt. And they share in the blame for their own decline to some degree. The biggest factor, though, has been that corporations have really set out to stomp on unions. And this was a movement that, surprisingly to me in my own research, it traces its roots all the way back to the late 50s, even when there was still a strong social contract. But corporations increasingly from that point began to take what's in the management literature defined as a hard line against organized labor. And many employers since then have been bent on doing whatever it takes, whether it's through means, you know, legal or illegal.
They will spend often more money to fight the union than it would have cost them to give in to workers' demands.
I don't think that's true, actually. So if you actually look at the numbers, I think they do it precisely because it is of, you know, in terms of raw economics. And again, if you're trying to maximize shareholder value, it's the thing to do.
I guess it's the long-term expenses that they're looking at.
Yeah, and even, you know, right. I mean, look, if you look, I've looked at some of the numbers. David Weil, who was in the Obama Labor Department, scholar, has looked at this. And, you know, even if the penalties are not very much, I mean, they amount to somewhere, if you really violate labor law, into typically hundreds of thousands of dollars in penalties. That's a lot less than you're going to pay. And, you know, so you add in some expense for an anti-union campaign to counter an organizing drive, and you hire some consultants and you make some over-the-top videos suggesting all kinds of terrible things will happen if the company is unionized, you know, that doesn't cost very much versus what the kinds of wage and benefit gains that organized labor could wrest at the bargaining table. Hmm. And so I think that employers, by and large, have calculated that it's just economically better to beat back unions than to accept them.
I'm just wondering if you can go through and looking at the four corporations that you trace in your book, GM, General Electric, Kodak, and Coca-Cola, what the culture of those companies is today. Where are those companies today?
Mm-hmm. So again, this is a long arc of history, and you know, look, they all kind of have a different place now than they did historically. So GM, of course, was in some ways the paradigmic company of the 20th century. And it, you know, did end up with a very strong social contract, again, in large part because of gains wrested by the United Auto Workers. But, you know, again, there was also a more of a paternalistic culture for a long time at GM. And some would say it went too far, that it actually, it's one of the reasons that GM ended up, promised so much to its workers, particularly on the healthcare and pension front, that it became uncompetitive. It was one reason the company became uncompetitive and ultimately landed in bankruptcy court. Kodak, you know, they had their own missteps as a business and didn't embrace digital photography quickly enough. You know, they're now like GM. And even more, a shadow of what they were in terms of size and scale and impact as a business. They also landed in bankruptcy court and have come out the other end, but really aren't a film company anymore. They're kind of a commercial copier company at this point, making copying equipment. And you know, you've had two companies that by and large have done quite well over this long arc of history as companies in terms of Coca-Cola and General Electric. They've had their ups and downs. Coca-Cola in some ways may be facing a bit of a long-term existential crisis. It still makes most of its money from selling soda, and there are all kinds of obvious health questions and Americans and people around the world changing their drinking habits and going away from sugary drinks. So, you know, there are real questions there. But those two companies have by and large done very well. From the worker standpoint, the interesting thing to me is that whether you look at the two companies that struggled and ultimately went bankrupt, in GM and Kodak, or the two that have done quite well over this long arc of history, in GE and Coca-Cola, the story is really the same for their workers. Doesn't matter whether you've worked at one of the winners or, you know, one of the losers.
So the devolution and worker treatment isn't linked to how these companies did?
No, it's really not. If you look in each case, I mean, to varying degrees, it's obviously worse if the company went bankrupt and they had huge, huge, massive layoffs. But in common at all four are, over that arc, declining job security, lower stagnant pay, particularly for frontline workers, and often two-tier wage structures in factories where there's actually much lower pay than workers used to have in real terms over time. Certainly declining healthcare benefits and declining retirement security. So it didn't matter whether, you know, which one you were at. It's the story is very common.
And then finally, Rick, you have, of course, the newer companies today. I mentioned Uber and all the tech companies in particular that love to use these words like disrupting the economy, the gig economy, et cetera. How far have they gone towards, in a way, dehumanizing their workers? And, you know, is there a point at which the pendulum will swing back when they realize you can only push people so far?
So, yeah, I look at those two questions. I'll separate those out quickly.
Okay.
So first, in terms of, you know, Silicon Valley and tech, there's really two ends to that economy. So on the high end, we're in a knowledge economy. Again, these paths you used to be able to take in a factory where you could walk in with little or no education, you know, even less than a high school degree. And it was tough work. It was backbreaking work. It is over romanticized in some ways, but you could find a path to the middle class in those jobs. Those have largely disappeared. And so what's replaced it are two things. At the high end is knowledge work, and Silicon Valley companies like Google and Apple and Facebook, if you're lucky enough to have the education and skills and talented enough, you can do great. Those are great places to work. There's good pay, there's great perks, there's strong benefits. It's wonderful. So being a knowledge worker today is great. But what's replaced a lot of those middle kind of class jobs, those factory jobs, are now low-end service jobs. Many of them, and an increasing number of them, as you say, are left to people who are in temp jobs or independent work, often with extremely low pay. Very little in terms of, if anything, in terms of benefits. And so Silicon Valley to me is a great representative of how the economy is increasingly split between a very high end, concentrated in the hands of relatively few, the lucky of us who have these knowledge jobs, and then an increasing number at the low end. And economists talk about this hollowing out in the middle. And I think that's the real story, what Silicon Valley represents.
Well, Rick, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and discussing your book. Good luck to you.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
My guest is Rick Wortsman, director of the K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute. It's part of the Claremont Graduate University. His earlier books include Obscene and the Extreme, The King of California, and What Would Drucker Do Now? We've been discussing his new book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.